Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Daniel P. Keating, a professor of psychology, psychiatry, and pediatrics at the University of Michigan in the US. He's the author of several books, including Developmental Health and the Wealth of Nations, Nature and Nurture in Early Child Development, and he's here to talk to us today about his latest book, Born Anxious, The Lifelong Impact of Early Life Adversity and How to Break the Cycle. Hello, Dan. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thanks very much for inviting me and having me on.
Well, you're welcome. Okay, well, one of the main research areas in the book is focused on the field of epigenetics. Could you perhaps begin by giving us an overview of that and how it relates to anxiety?
Sure. So the large picture that I don't spend a lot of time on the book is what epigenetics in general is. And the simplest way to understand it, I find, is to recognize that genes are designed, they're laid down in a sense at the point of conception with a particular DNA structure. They tell the cells, organize the cells in terms of what they're supposed to do based on a variety of those genetic factors. What epigenetics is basically a after-the-fact change to the way particular kinds of cells may behave. Okay. So genes have instructions to do particular kinds of chemical things, produce particular proteins and so forth. But in addition, they have a part of the gene that's often referred to as a promoter or regulator part of the gene. And that essentially says to that gene, do more of what it is you're supposed to do, do less of what it is that you're designed to do, stop doing what you're supposed to do. That regulator gene, that regulator portion, I should say, of the gene, can then be affected by what are known as epigenetic changes. And these are things that make that particular part of the gene affected in a way that causes it to do more or less or even shut off in light of various things that happen. In the broad field of epigenetics, there are many different things that can lead to these epigenetic changes happening, including just normal housekeeping that goes on during the fetal life. There's another sector that where they are susceptible to various kinds of physical intrusions. Toxins of various sorts can make epigenetic changes. We think now that a good part of why lead affects fetuses so dramatically is through epigenetic mechanisms. The one that I'm particularly focused on is a relatively newer field of social epigenetics. And essentially what that says is that what you experience either in the womb as early as that or early in life, particularly with respect to the things I'm interested in, can change the way particular genes function. And in the book, I look at a very specific gene that is part of the feedback loop that tells the stress response system to stop what it's doing. We've had enough, we're good, and it tells the stress system to stand down. That can be epigenetically modified to remove that feedback information so that in a sense the stress system stays on much more constantly than it is healthy in the long run to do.
So that can happen in the womb or in early childhood, or can that happen later on in life too?
What I'm focused on for this particular gene is what we think we know from much of the animal research and now increasing amounts of human research is that it sets what that stress response system is going to do, and it typically does it in early life, either in fetal life or in the first year or so of life. That, in a sense, sets up the physiology of the system to be either on constant high alert or to be more modulated and regulated depending on what's going on. So one of the ways I think it's useful to think about it is that it's essentially how genes listen to the environment. We now know that the brain listens to the environment. It wires up in terms of the particular experiences. We now know that that happens to genes as well, including, you know, social information. In the womb, it's more physical information, but it comes from the social situation of the mother, which is that if she's overstressed, hyperstressed, is experiencing very high levels of stress, cortisol can come into the amniotic sac, can come into the womb, and that high level of cortisol essentially is a signal to the fetus that this is a very stressful, likely dangerous situation. So you probably should come out being ready to be on high alert from the very get-go. In early infancy, it's the same sort of story. If parents are not available for whatever reasons, their own stress, material circumstances, very dangerous things like being in a conflict or war zone, that signals too that if the right nurturing isn't happening, that it's probably because there's some danger out there in the world and you need to be on high alert. And this, of course, is the same mechanism, essentially the same mechanism across, as far as we know, all mammals that we've studied. It's a way that the genes listen to the environment. In this case, a gene that regulates the stress system is listening to the environment that's telling them it's dangerous. Yeah. And so it says the way to get along in the world is to be on knife's edge as much as you possibly can.
Okay. So in many ways, this challenges the whole nature-nurture debate. You know, epigenetics seems to indicate that they are inextricably linked.
Absolutely. I think that's becoming true in virtually everything that we look at in terms of human development or, you know, animal development for that matter. But essentially everything is an interaction there. Once we understand that the brain listens to the environment, the genes listen to the environment, it's fine-tuning an organism to be in the particular circumstance it is. Now, it misfires, right? I mean, it's not a perfect system. In this case, they can tell the organism to be on super high alert all the time. But in fact, that infant may be getting born into, has already been born into a relatively, you know, milder, normal, Western, educated, rich environment, and that just causes problems for them. It might be of continued use. If you're born into a conflict zone, maybe it's a good thing to be always on alert.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's look at early childhood. So you say in the book there are three experiences in particular that stand out in terms of maintaining optimal mental health for a child. So what are they?
Well, in terms of the response to these situations, the things that are really important are, and it actually repeats itself later in life as well, but a big one is social connection, is being able to have a strong nurturing relationship, a strong attachment relationship, where in effect what you're getting through that is a sense that there is a trusting relationship with the world, that things are relatively okay, and therefore you can get along in the world. And so that comes through that sort of social bonding. It has good, it builds up the systems that create good hormones that are actually counteractive to stress, particularly oxytocin, which is in the close bonding relationship with a parent, particularly with moms, particularly during breastfeeding, but also serotonin, the ability to extract positive neurohormone elevated mood kinds of things from social relationships. So that's kind of the biggest part. Another big part, and it's very closely related to that, is the sense of touch. That is that you have a physical connection with the world, yeah, that it's a trustful, meaningful sort of thing. So there's that component of it, which is you know, sort of related to you know, attachment kinds of things, but is in a sense, it's important enough that I think it deserves to be, you know, seen as a standalone kind of thing. And then in terms of going through early childhood, gradually for parents to gradually be granting a little bit more in terms of autonomy. You know, long ago, Erickson talked about autonomy as an early childhood kind of phenomenon, that there's some opportunity that you can control things that are happening in the world. Right. So if you think of a new infant as essentially having virtually no self-regulatory skills, they can't control really anything, right? Yeah. All they can do is say, I'm distressed, feed me, change me, hold me, whatever it might be, right? Over the period, even in early childhood, they're moving towards beginning to make some decisions on their own. And that is a shift towards them being able to internally self-regulate. And that's a kind of thing where parents need to then begin to negotiate. These are all components of just good parenting in the sense that Winnicott talked about it or other people talked about it. It is those components. What I think is a little different now is that we understand that that can play a significant role, if you will, in the fact that nurture becomes nature. These things get under the skin and can regulate a lifetime of how you're going to deal with and interact with the world.
And when you say nurture becomes nature, if, you know, in layperson's terms, if the stress response is fused into the on position, how fixed is that?
Well, I guess there's two answers. One, so far as we know, we don't know how to unfuse it in a biological sense at this point. That is, with that system in place, after, say, the first year or year and a half of life, if that's the system in place, it is likely to always have the situation of being prepared to fire off more readily, to go to a somewhat higher level of response, and take a longer time to come back to baseline compared to individuals who have a more typically regulated stress system. On the other hand, what we also know is there are a variety of things that can mitigate or work around that particular sort of thing, and it changes over the course of development. Social connection, which we've already talked about, is one of the best ways that we know of to create a mitigation to that hyper-responsive stress system, so that in effect, what it does is it creates more opportunities for the counter agent neurochemicals like oxytocin and serotonin to do their thing.
Yeah.
Touch stimulates that as well. Good social connections. And as individuals get older, it's not just the biological response. You have social support. You have friends who can say, oh, look at it this way. Don't look at it that way. You know, understand more about what's going on. So it has a social support mechanism comes into that as well.
Yeah.
So that's a big mitigator. Another mitigator or workaround is, as we get even more capable in terms of our advanced cognitive functions, when we look at what the prefrontal cortex is up to, what we see is the broad range of things that people now refer to as mindfulness, being able to understand the situation that you're in. So, for example, if you learn the habit of stopping to think about the situation rather than letting the stress system trigger itself and say, oh, wait a minute, let me put this in a bigger frame here, then you may stop that. You may prevent it from firing off in a sense. And then a third big one that becomes relevant, most relevant at any point, but becomes even more relevant as we grow older, is taking care of our physical body. So exercise is a great moderator of the degree of cortisol that's floating in our system. Good sleep is essential, because bad sleep means that these activities just get carried away, and so forth. And abusing various substances, whether they're psychoactive substances, alcohol, drugs, or comfort food, which have negative health ramifications, those do tend to reduce the cortisol level in the immediate, but have long-term health negative outcomes.
Okay. And but you also mentioned in the book this notion of super nurturing, and give the example of the Romanian orphan children, that if they were caught early and ended up in very caring families, even though they suffered from stress dysregulation, they can sometimes, or they quite often, they actually manage to turn that around.
Yes, if it occurs early enough, right? So in a sense, what seems to be the data, and the folks who are studying that are continuing to follow up, but basically is that if individuals, it looks as though the cutoff for actually kind of reversing this stress dysregulation system is around somewhere between 6 months and 12 months, right? So if they move into the super nurturing situation during that period of time, it looks as though, in fact, they can get a relatively normative physiological stress system during that period of time. After about a year or so, they can develop various kinds of mechanisms that can help, but you don't get that kind of what looks like pretty much a true reversal that can happen early on. But the super nurturing is hard to do with infants who are in that circumstance, because they're very hard to soothe. They're very hard to help them be regulated. And so it is a difficult sort of thing to do. And by implication, the same thing is true of individuals not from such severely traumatic early experiences as the Romanian orphanage children, but who, for a variety of reasons, may be stress dysregulated. That super nurturing, it looks as though that can have that impact. We know better from animal models, but certainly from some human data, that in fact can have the same effect, not only in severely traumatized children, but in sort of the relatively broader range of stress dysregulated children.
Yeah.
The difficulty, of course, is pulling it off as a parent, because it's a demanding task.
Sure, and that raised two questions here, because one of the things with epigenetics is that it's not that you can pass this on genetically, these symptoms or these biological changes, but you pass them on epigenetically. So if your mum suffered from stress dysregulation, there's a possibility that you could be too.
Yes, I mean, I would say that this is not totally settled science at this point in time, but we are getting to the point where it looks highly, I would say, highly probable. The difficulty, yes. So basically the story is, and I'll quickly say what we're not entirely sure about yet. Yeah. The basic story is that if you have this epigenetic modification, in this particular case that I'm talking about, it's known as DNA methylation. The gene is methylated, which means that there's a methyl group attaches to that regulator portion, and it functions in a way that it doesn't produce that shutoff valve that we were talking about earlier. That biological epigenetic change, it does appear to be the case that the epigenetic change can be inherited, so that the epigenetic methylation can get carried over to the next generation. Yeah. The tricky part is that particularly if it's through the maternal line, we don't know that, because the fetus already has the female fetus has the eggs in it, the change could happen there. So we're knowing better now from animal models because the generations are a lot faster. So I would think it's not going tremendously out on a limb at all. I think it's clearly pointing in the direction that that is the case. Now that combines with, for stress dysregulated mothers, it combines with the fact that their capability to provide that sort of nurturing, normal nurturing or super nurturing in particular, may be compromised. So it's probably a combination of their behavioral ability to nurture, because they're super stressed. If their baby's stressed, they get stressed.
Yeah.
It's harder to do. But it may also be an inheritance pathway as well.
I can imagine, although in many ways this is an empowering, you know, information about how we function, because we can actually change our biology, but also imagine it can generate anxiety as well, especially for, you know, say expectant mothers or parents who experience something traumatic. It could be a loss of a job or bereavement or something wider like an earthquake, or they could be in a war situation. And then they've got also the worry that through their stress, then they're going to affect the baby. So what advice would you give to parents to manage that?
Well, first, I agree. I think it is empowering to understand that this can happen, right? That this is a risk that's out there. Yeah. In the same way, we now understand risks of lots of things like tobacco smoking and so forth. Now, it's not so easy. Well, I want to say that stopping smoking is easy, but it's not so easy to say, oh, just change that one behavior. Because if you've got someone who's in a seriously stressful situation, like a conflict zone, let's say, they may not have much control over how much stress they're going to experience. It's not in their control.
Yeah.
But I would say that the message is to the extent that it is possible to mitigate or control the amount of stress that's experienced during that particular critical period of life, when the mother is expecting, the stress on the mother, when there are young parents, when parents are parenting a newborn, both of them or whatever caretakers are available, that they're become very conscious of trying to modulate their stressful reactions as much as possible.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's a tall order if the broader environment that you're in is stress-producing in a major way, right? Some of those are structural. You can't change them. If you're homeless, you're not going to be able to say, oh, well, okay, I'm homeless, but I'm not stressed about it. I mean, that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So we have to then invoke the larger societal picture, is to provide whatever supports we possibly can, both for expectant mothers, but also for parents of newborns and infants, in order to try structurally to reduce the stress that they're getting exposed to.
Okay. And then how far are we down the line in terms of, for example, going to your doctor, whether they can ascertain that you biologically are stress methylated?
Yeah, we don't have a specific mechanism for doing that sort of biological, at this point in time, doing that kind of biological assay as a routine medical procedure. More often is if it's severe enough that it's impacting your life or impacting the lives of others around you, it's likely to be more leading to a primarily behaviorally or mental health-based diagnosis like anxiety or depression or explosive anger, or those sorts of things. And in those cases where those diagnoses are appropriate, they may come from stress dysregulation. They don't come only from stress dysregulation. But if that's what's being presented phenotypically in the medical situation, then treating them in the same way that you would treat that effectively for anyone who's presenting with that particular kind of syndrome or clinical diagnosis or symptomatology would be the way to go. So the sorts of things that are, you know, often prescribed for things like anxiety or depression are very likely to work if it, whether it arises from stress dysregulation or from some other thing. So if it's serious enough that one feels the need to have medical intervention, then in a sense, there's no reason to expect that the medical interventions that are effective in general would be effective for individuals whose source of the problem is that.
Let's move on now to another important theme in your book, and I'll quote it from the book. You say, if once in our early history, tigers were the hunters that triggered our stress reactions, steep social inequality is the predator that has so many of us living with dread today. Now, that's a claim that could have enormous consequences. Could you unpack that for us a little bit?
Sure. So one of the things that we understand, I think, pretty clearly now, robustly, is that there are fairly dramatic effects or associated patterns with social gradient. So our social gradient runs from at the low end, low socioeconomic status, disadvantage, and so forth, at the high end, wealth, lots of advantages, and so forth and so on. And it's a gradient or a ladder that connects those two sorts of things. And we know from lots and lots of studies everywhere that all of these developmental outcomes and health outcomes are associated with that gradient, right? So the higher up on the social status you are, the less likely you are to suffer from various kinds of health and developmental problems. Lower down, much more probable than that. But we also know that the steepness of that social ladder differs by countries. It differs spatially, right? Some countries have very steep social ladders. If you wind up in problematic situations of being low on that ladder or even middle low on that ladder, there are serious consequences. Other places, other countries have much shallower gradients, much less steep ladders. So the consequences of being lower down on the ladder are much less. We know that those countries that have steep ladders overall have poorer health, shorter longevity, worse developmental outcomes like educational achievement, a whole bunch of things, right? So we know that that's the case. The other thing we know is that, at least in terms of the last 4 or 5 decades, that process of inequality has been accelerating, but it's been accelerating more in some places than others. It's been accelerating more in the places that already had relatively steep inequality, US and UK among the steepest. And so what we know is that those associated outcomes, those life history outcomes that are associated with inequality, are problematic. So the essential connection here would be through looking at, are there any biological indicators that suggest that this inequality is getting under our skin, yeah, and affecting our health through these sorts of biological mechanisms? And I know the US data better. I haven't I've looked internationally at broad comparisons, but not the more specific ones. But here are a couple of things that we find. When we look at the data in the United States that comes from the Center for Disease Control, a whole host of stress-related disorders and diseases have been increasing substantially over the last 4 decades, on the order of 20 to 25%. We're talking about obesity, metabolic disorders, sleep disorders, a variety of those sorts of things. So it looks as though, even at the level of disorders and diseases, we're seeing stress-related ones increasing more rapidly than other kinds of things like cancers. The second piece is that we also now have some very good data in the U.S. from looking at what we would know are stress-related physiological indicators. So these are not actual diseases or disorders, but these are things that are precursors to them. High cholesterol, things that measure kidney function or liver function. And in creating what we can think of as a stress load index of that physiology, what we have seen is that over the whole population in the U.S. from the late 70s until now, that's been increasing substantially, mm-hmm, and it's beginning more unequal, that it has affected everyone, but it's affected the individuals in the lower and middle end of that social gradient, social ladder, more so than individuals at the top. So the combination is that, I mean, it is a bit of a stretch. We're talking about fundamental molecular level biological changes and broad social patterns, but I don't think it's a huge stretch once we understand how central the stress response is to the embedding of inequality in our bodies that lead to these things.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting in the book was a study you talked about actually in the UK in the 50s of these civil servants, and back to your ladder idea that whatever your health outcome was related to your position on the ladder. So even though if you were, you know, a middle class civil servant that, you know, you were able to go on holiday and provide for your family and you were quite secure, you still had significantly worse health outcomes than someone at the top of the ladder, but better outcomes than someone at the bottom. Is that roughly correct?
That is correct. This is the Sir Michael Marmot's Whitehall studies, which have been very influential in the field, and for a couple of reasons. One is that it's possible to rule out, or not rule out, but identify how important other things we might think of would be. So, for example, in the States, a big part of the argument is the reason we have such unequal health outcomes is that people at the middle and lower end may not have access to health insurance or coverage, right? They may not get health care that they need. Because of National Health Service, that's less likely. I don't want to say it's never the case that you get identically good service, but everyone has access to core health care, right? Yes. So we can rule that out. We can say a lot of other people would say, well, it's lifestyle, because individuals who are lower down, who are, you know, sort of lower level civil servants compared to individuals at the top, may eat less healthy ways. They may exercise less. They may smoke more or whatever. So you can assess those things. In this case, it was assessed by asking people what they did. When you put all of those other factors together, it does account for some of those differences, but it still leaves, you know, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of that difference between top and bottom unexplained.
Yeah.
We still haven't explained what's going on. So something else has to be going on. And the notion that it's something that's gotten under the skin then becomes a much more probable explanation for what's going on.
And what do you think it is? Okay, we've talked about the fact that we're social creatures, you know, that's a big part of our makeup, but we're also resource-seeking creatures. Part of that is also status and achieving things. Do you think when that part of our makeup is not fully realized, then that can make us feel stressed?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think there's been a bit of a debate in the field, which I think is a little bit of a red herring, to be honest with you. But the debate is between, are the primary reasons for this unexplained part of the differences, right? Is it primarily psychosocial, right, around status issues, dominance issues, your status in the world, that if it's lower than you'd like it to be, you feel stressed about that because you see people above you and that bothers you. And so that's a stressful – that's a simplification, but it's a stressful situation, right? The other is access to material resources, which, you know, is probably not hugely important in the U.S., certainly in deep poverty it is, because food insecurity and homelessness and so forth can be a substantial fear stressor, because you don't know that you'll have the resources you need on a day-to-day basis. On the social side, I think it's not just what your current situation is, but your fear and uncertainty about the future. If you are in a steep inequality or a steep ladder society, the consequences of sliding down are much worse. So if you're a society that has a strong safety net, and if you get laid off from your job, what that means is, oh, we'll support you at your salary while you do a year of retraining. That's a whole different thing to say, you're out the door, good luck, bud. You know, here's 2 weeks severance and you're on your own, right?
Yeah.
Two very different situations, right? And so the degree to which we have invested in supports for human development from early on throughout life, those things are, and our research tends to support this, are very much protective against the degree to which inequality gets under the skin and causes these problems. So the steep inequality is not just the present moment, but your anticipation or fears or uncertainty about the future, or your children's future, for that matter.
Sure. Okay, well, this brings me to my next question. I think we've probably answered it anyway, but a few days ago, just by coincidence, I was having a discussion with various people on Facebook about social inequality, and one person is skeptical about whether it's wrong or not. And anyway, I mentioned that I was going to be interviewing you, and he's posed this question. He said, in terms of human well-being and a reduction in anxiety, Which of the following two future scenarios would be preferable? A, a situation much like today, but where tax policy has massively shifted the tax burden to high earners such that inequality is substantially lower. Or B, a situation where rising demand for labour and rising real wages for the lower and middle classes produce an ongoing rise in living standards for them and a rise in the availability of jobs, but inequality continues to grow.
I would think that the argument would very much have to be in favor of the former, although I don't necessarily think these are mutually exclusive outcomes. I don't think high inequality is a necessary state for having growing economies. In fact, there's some very good work that's been done by Hall and Soskis in a book called Varieties of Capitalism that they followed up, which essentially poses the question, is a kind of a more neoliberal, individualistic free market economy more likely to produce growth, which is one of the arguments that's often used, as opposed to a more coordinated economy where there are various kinds of arrangements to maintain employment, maintain various kinds of arrangements that enhance individuals' participation in a labor economy, even as the economy shifts to various kinds of things. And their answer, based on like four decades of post-World War II data, very clearly says that you don't get more growth with one than the other. There's broad economic growth as possible under either of those regimes, right? So I think in a sense it's a kind of a false dichotomy. The reason why I think that the former is, if we may have to make a choice, is that we have to think about, well, what are the opportunities that we gain by having greater revenue by limiting the super rich escaping taxation, right? So the super rich escape taxation, it not only increases inequality, it decreases the amount of revenue that we have available to support human development. It reduces the amount that we have to provide protections for moms who are expecting babies. It provides support for parental leave. It provides support for early childhood education and learning and development and throughout life. So I think that the notion that we can there are two big ways, it seems to me, to reduce social inequality. Well, three, but two that we can quantify. The one is the degree of income inequality. They're not perfectly related. Income inequality and social inequality are not perfectly related, but it is a part of it. It's an important part of it. And the evidence over four decades across all the OECD, the rich Western type countries, suggests that moderating income inequality decreases social inequality. And we have some of our work was focused on that specifically. So that's one of the factors. The other is those societies that can reduce social inequality by investing more in human development, early childhood education, labor support, labor retraining, and so forth. The amount of human investment and the decrease or mitigation of income inequality are the two big quantitative factors that drive the amount of social inequality in health, education, and developmental outcomes that we observe.
Okay. I'd be interested to know how SDR might even affect the way we vote.
I suspect that it affects a lot of things. My hunch would be that in terms of electoral behavior is that to the degree that we have a substantial amount of SDR around in the population for whatever reasons, epigenetic or other reasons, I think it probably makes such individuals much more susceptible to fear and anger responses. Yeah. They're much less likely to be able to moderate, sort of that stressful reaction. And so I think appeals that are based on those negative emotions, fear, anger, resentment, and so forth, are likely to be more appealing to a broader segment of the population if SDR is afoot in major ways.
That makes sense to me as well, and especially when, in countries like the UK and US that tend to be high on the social inequality scale, and we've just experienced Brexit and Trump, right, as well. Yeah. Okay. And then this relates a little bit to how we vote. To what degree is stress contagious?
Increasingly, we're finding it substantially contagious. So it's contagious, we've known for a while, behaviorally. So if I'm in a situation where someone's being emotionally angry, I'm likely to start feeling anger or fear myself, right? So there's this emotional contagion. more recent research, and particularly in looking at how businesses and firms operate and looking at various work teams, and schools for that matter too, one of the things that we're observing is that it becomes physiologically contagious. So that in a sense, if an individual, by directly measuring things like cortisol, when a group gets riled up, if you will, when the stress goes up, it tends to show up in the physiological response of the other people in the group. So in a sense, groups become coordinated around what the average stress level is. So if it's very high, it's going to be a very high stress situation, as opposed to a more moderated or modulated situation.
So we talked about potentially what we can do about stress from an individual level. So what do you think we can do from a political and a societal level?
A few things. One is, I think that we're talking about fairly big systemic changes. So this isn't going to be, you know, I think it's going to be hard to make dramatic kinds of things. Yeah. But based on the work that we've done and that others have done, the ones that I already mentioned, I think to the degree that we let any income inequality get worse, right, as opposed to perhaps a bit less, that's likely across time to have a negative impact. The more that we concentrate resources in the hands of an ever smaller group and leave other folks behind, that looks as though it's going to have a negative impact on inequality and health inequality and educational outcomes and other developmental outcomes. So that's one. And I think obviously we can say, well, it seems like a difficult non-starter at the moment. But on the other hand, some countries do a better job of that, you know, so there are models out there one can look to. The other one that's perhaps a little more politically feasible, although I'm not so sure in our immediate U.S. situation it's highly feasible, but, you know, things change politically, is increasing our investment in human development, and particularly early on, to the degree that we cannot burden folks with, from the beginning in fetal life or infancy, with this difficulty in learning how to navigate the world in a way that keeps stress modulated, allows people to cope and so forth, is a very big one, as well as protecting them against physical toxins that have the same effect, right? So here in Michigan, where I am, Flint, Michigan, has had this terrible situation with the lead-tainted water, and its consequences are going to be severe. So protecting people from various kinds of toxins, obviously that's a human development investment for all of us, but particularly important for young individuals. And I think, this more nebulous, if you will, but political viewpoints, which essentially regard various kinds of taking care of others as a joint collective venture where we say, okay, yes, this is an important thing to do, as opposed to everybody's on their own. I think one of the things, and we unfortunately are going sort of in the opposite direction for a while, hopefully not for too long here in the States, but one of the things that we can look at, it seems to me, is that when we're thinking about those sorts of things, is to say, where are some of the comparisons? So one of the studies that we did was to look at the U.S. versus Canada, both of which tend to be steep in inequality compared to the, you know, large set of countries as a whole. But between them, there's a distinct advantage to Canada. For example, people in Canada, I live there, I'm a dual citizen. There's a sense that healthcare is a right. It's not something no political party is going to say we ought to take that away. So even though they're on the overall higher inequality group, there are certain things that get embedded. Once they get embedded, they tend to stay. And so we can see potentially some gradual progress there. The difficulty that the Trump administration has had in dismantling Obamacare in the States is a good example of that. Once people see that as something they should have, they don't want to give it up.
Yeah.
So I seeing this not as a charity to others, but as part of our benefit to our whole population, I think we need to keep pushing that in that direction as well.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, what's your understanding of the middle way, Dan, and how might that possibly relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think that it is that if you think of, I mean, you know, I'm learning more as I've looked into this and partly in preparation for our conversation. But one of the things that I think is very interesting to think about is that very much like a stress system, where not enough stress doesn't get you anywhere. You've got to get a bit of stress in order to get up and get going and doing things.
Yeah.
Stress disables you. It makes you too angry to work or too angry to interact well, or too scared to interact with other people and so forth. There is a kind of a middle spot, a well-regulated middle spot, where we essentially say, okay, we can go in a variety of directions with these sorts of things. Now, it's obviously a metaphor for looking at it at a societal level, yeah. But I don't think it's a bad metaphor, right? And essentially, if folks come together and say, I don't have all the answers, you don't have all the answers, but if we remain calm, if you will, and think through these things, where would we go with this? What would be a good thing to do? The other thing, and I don't know whether this is explicitly a part of the middle way message or not, but one of the other things, of course, from my perspective as a scientist, is to say, you know, these are all empirical questions. Let's decide what outcomes we want. What are the sorts of social arrangements that gets us closer to those outcomes, right? We don't have to argue on the basis of ideology or tribalism primarily. Yeah. We should argue it on the basis of what works the best, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we've in fact got now, as our technical tools have improved, our ability to look at epidemiological and population things much better, our ability as we've added more and more cohorts of babies that we follow over time. We're launching another one here in the States just now that I'm involved with on a large scale. The more we have those kinds of data, the easier it is to ask the question, what are the kinds of policies that work? What are the kinds of arrangements, social arrangements, that maximize the best outcomes for everybody? And if we commit ourselves to saying, oh, look, I'm going to reserve judgment. My ideology might be, you know, sort of strong democratic socialist, or my ideology is much more towards a neoliberal market-based system. Let's just say, okay, those are our starting hypotheses. Well, what works? Let's put it into place and see what works.
Yeah.
And we can now evaluate what works. And I think that would be, to me, that seems like the obvious analogy to kind of seeing what works in terms of how we regulate our own selves in our own lives.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's to me is a great expression in the middle way. In fact, one of our great heroes is John Dewey, the American pragmatist, who, you know, basically has the same message. Yeah. Anyway, our last question, Dan. How hopeful are you that we can break this cycle?
I'm actually quite hopeful, but I mean that's partly my personality. But I always think that, you know, you work towards those things that are going to be positive, and you hope for the opportunity that they can come about. But the concrete reasons that I'm hopeful is I think we actually are embarked on at the moment in ways that are quite stressful and anxiety making and disturbing to many of us. We are embarking on an experiment that says, well, what would much more in the way of individualistic competition all against all, not going into collaborative arrangements, withdrawing from collaborative arrangements, we're giving that an experiment. And it seems to me that the data are starting to come in pretty rapidly that experiment is not working. One hopes that becomes a broader view. People say, look, no, that isn't what we wanted. We didn't want to have a situation where we're undercutting ourselves. We didn't want a situation where on the basis of our ideological beliefs or our tribes or some other thing, that what we're doing is we ought to go in this thing full-fledged. We've gone pretty full-fledged in the U.S. and the U.K. in particular, and it doesn't look like it's working out particularly well. If that's the case, then people take a look at that and say, wait a second, let's step back a second. What's a good model? Now, there's an argument as to whether you step back and go very far in the other direction, or you step back and say, okay, let's take a look at where we are and what's a good way forward. There's a debate to be had on that. It's a debate that's going on in the Democratic Party here in the United States between the, you know, sort of the, you know, full out, you know, Medicare for all Sanders version versus the more incremental versions. That's still an argument we're going to have. Mm-hmm. But both of them are around similar goals. What we want to do is to improve people's lot, and we'd like to do that by doing something that works. And so I think that's my optimism comes from the fact that trying the other way is happening, and people don't seem to be particularly liking it, although there's certainly still a whole lot of factionalism and tribalism that's driving the way that it gets presented to us and the way that we see it.
Okay, yeah. Well, I second that. And also, I'd just say that I thoroughly enjoyed your book. I thought it was a real eye-opener. And also, epigenetics has been around for 20, 30 years now, and I've been trying to get my head around it. And the way you wrote the book was pitched in a very digestible way, which was fantastic. You know, I hope that the book is a real agent for change and really support your work. And thank you very much for talking to me today, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for your comments, and it was delightful to chat with you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.